Should we allow a foreign company to lead a proposed monorail project between Miami and Miami Beach? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami-Dade County Commission voted to move forward with a bid for a company to build a monorail between the two cities. The company at the front of that bid, and the one leading the push for it, is Genting, the Malaysian casino company. We want to hear from you. Is this a good idea? Would you use it? Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Also, it feels really hot out there. It's because temperatures around the world are going up. And a new study shows that at this rate, within a few decades, places like South Florida can expect many more days of temperatures feeling like they're over 100 degrees. Finally, we know robots and technology are creeping into all parts of our lives. We'll learn about how Miami-Dade College is using new tech to teach future doctors. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it can be frustrating getting around Miami-Dade with traffic. And for people who live in Miami Beach, you know the clutter of cars to cross a couple of bridges. Well, the Miami-Dade County Commission recently voted to move forward with a potential bid for the potential construction of perhaps a monorail across Biscayne Bay. The casino company Genting, which owns the land where the old Miami Herald building once stood, would like to build it. How do you feel about that? What questions do you have about the project? Who would use it? Would you? Well, we heard from some of you, like Stuart in Hallandale Beach. I think passenger ferry service between downtown Miami and South Beach is a better option than a monorail. There would be no disruption of traffic for construction to provide the service like monorail construction on the MacArthur Causeway would entail. Like a monorail, road traffic would not affect ferries. It would be an even more beautiful, enjoyable, and short ride. Again, find us on Sundial at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know your thoughts, your questions. Joining me now is Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. Mayor Jimenez, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure, as always.
All right. There's been conversations about trying to, you know, figure out the best system of public transportation to get between Miami and Miami Beach for many years. Why is this happening now? Why this conversation? And we'll get to the details, but why this conversation now about a monorail?
Well, the only reason we're talking about a monorail is we got an unsolicited proposal about a monorail and a monorail system and a very detailed proposal that would propose to build a monorail from Miami Beach to the Genting site. There was very detailed, a lot of detail on the financing of such a project, how much it would cost, how much they would we'd be asking of the county government, state government, no federal funding involved. And there was a significant amount of money that was going to be put in by the private sector. And so whenever you receive an unsolicited proposal, and this is guided by the law, by the way, whenever I receive, the county receives an unsolicited proposal, and remember, it's the term unsolicited. Nobody asked for it.
Genting came to you?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there is a process, and it's actually laid out in state law. If you have a good idea, and if you have a way to finance it, and you think it's something that would be beneficial to a government, any government, city government, state government, county government, you can, in the way the county government, you have to pay a $25,000 upfront payment for us to be able to use that money for the evaluation of your proposal. And so my duty as mayor is to look at a proposal and say, okay, does it solve a problem here in Miami-Dade? Actually, you know, Baylink, the solution to Baylink, it is a problem that we've been talking about for a long time. Is it financially feasible? And the way the finances were laid out in the unsolicited proposal, it is feasible. So my duty as the mayor is to take and go to the commission and say, look, we have an unsolicited proposal. It solves a problem, and it is financially feasible.
You like the proposal. You asked the commission to vote, let's open the bid. And last week they voted, say, okay, let's open a bid.
It's not that I like the proposal. What I say is, does it solve a problem, and is it financially feasible? Yes, it's financially feasible, and it solves a problem, and it needs to be looked into. And now, what we proposed and what happens is we then issue an RFP, not based on this unsolicited proposal. The RFP that we're going to be putting out on the street is going to say we are looking for proposals. These are now this is a solicited proposal.
You're asking for companies to bid
on The technology could either be a monorail, it could be a metro mover, it could be bus rapid transit, or it could be light rail, because those are the modes of transportation that are being studied today by Parsons.
And that's the study that you're doing right now.
Correct.
When is that study supposed to be done?
It's supposed to be. We're supposed to go forward with some kind of a locally preferred alternative or alternatives, because it's a much broader area than just Baylink. Sometime in the fall, and so the process of actually writing the RFP will take at least a couple of months, and then we're asking the city of Miami and Miami Beach to help us in writing the RFP. The RFP, once written, then goes back to the commission, and they will either approve or disapprove the RFP, the wording, et cetera, what we're asking for. And again, we're not settling on any kind of technology. We're not settling on any kind of mode of transportation. We're not settling on any alignment. We're not settling on any. Or it has to start here. It has to end here. You can use your own imagination. We will be asking for, okay, what is it that you're proposing, and what is the financing of it? How do you expect to? What do you expect from the government, and what do you expect to put up yourself?
If the commission accepts that RFP at that point, then they open up the bidding.
It goes out into the world for 6 months. So companies have 6 months to then put together their teams, et cetera.
Is that enough time, though?
Of course it is. We put RFPs don't normally last, you know, that long. And so people have right from now 8 months, really, at least 8 months, because we're now preparing an RFP.
So but Genting has the upper hand because they put it forward first.
Yeah, but Genting also took their risk. I'm doing their, you know, they put up their money first, and they put up their risk that they could give us an unsolicited proposal and say we're not interested in. And so they have put up their money and their risk, whether we would say, yeah, it's something that we think it's feasible. But any other company in the world could have done exactly the same thing. That is the unsolicited proposal process, which allows you, if you think you have a good idea, to keep your idea kind of silent, okay? It's intellectual property, okay? That you, okay, I have this idea, and I want to put it forward to a government, whatever government. And by the way, this is all guided by law, state law.
But being an unsolicited proposal, it also allows for some secrecy. I mean, everything has to be open.
Correct.
All right, so, I mean, that comes up on the issue of transparency. And you're asking voters again to have faith in a system. We can't see it all.
You will see it all, actually, because
at the beginning. We have to wait until
But really, the beginning is the unsolicited proposal. All we do is it viable? Is it something that can be financed? Does it solve a problem? And that's it. The next process is completely open, and where the people have the right to weigh in on a number of different stages. Number one, they have the right to weigh in on the process of writing the RFP. The RFP will be brought back before the county commission in a public hearing and said, this is the request for proposals that we would want to put out in the street. That's one. The request for proposal goes out in the street. Then there is an evaluation process of all the responses, and then a vendor is either recommended or none of them are attractive enough, is not recommended. It goes before the county commission. All of the proposals are put on the table. All the proposals are seen and have the light of day. And then the county commission determines whether, A, they want to accept one of the proposals or they want to reject the entire thing. The unsolicited proposal, what it does, it spurs a public process. And that's where people, you know, don't understand. They think, oh, this is all cooked. It's behind the scenes. It's people are negotiating. We're not negotiating with anybody. I mean, we don't negotiate with anybody. You give us an unsolicited proposal. What we have to do by law and what my duty is to look at it. Is it a good idea? Does it have merit? Is it financeable? Is it something that needs to be brought forward to the commission?
And you said a couple of times already that this helps solve a problem. What do you see as the problem that needs to be solved?
The problem is what we've been talking about for 40 years, some kind of a connection between Miami Beach and downtown Miami, a Baylink. We've been talking about this for 30 or 40 years. So, yeah, it kind of solves that problem.
What can you tell us about their idea and how it would solve that problem?
Their idea, a lot of it is already public, but I had to, you know, one of the things is that the company allowed us actually to reveal more than what the law says that we can reveal. So we actually had to get a letter from them saying, look, we have to reveal something because a lot of this stuff is so, the community is speculating all over the place about what this thing is, that they're way off. And so The project is going to cost their proposal, not the project. Their proposal says that they could build a linkage between Miami and Miami Beach for about $400 million, in the area of $400 million, and that they would be putting in more than $150 million of their own money, that requesting about $100 million from the county and $100 million from the state, and then some money from the cities of Miami and Miami Beach. They would then construct a monorail. They would operate, they would design, build, operate, and maintain a monorail. They would be looking for operations and maintenance payments that are substantially less than the O&M payments that we have to make for the South Dade Rapid Transitway that we're developing.
They're operating it. Is it, what about oversight? How much of it, I mean, does the county have the oversight on, would they have the oversight on this project?
Of course. I mean, they would have to abide by a contract. Whoever wins this and whatever iteration it takes, at the end, the county has the oversight of it. You have to abide by a contract. You have to have certain performance measures that you must keep in order to get any kind of either availability payment or payment for operations and maintenance or whatever it is that comes out of this process.
Real quickly, what do you think about the fact that, I mean, recently you had both Republican senators, Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, say they've got grave concerns about this. Mm-hmm. And especially their words, fears of espionage from a foreign power. Genting is Malaysian, but there's a Chinese connection.
Yes, it's BYD. Now, BYD is not a Chinese state-controlled entity. Actually, BYD, the majority stockholder, as far as I know, is Warren Buffett. That's the company. And now, but they do manufacture in China. So what I've responded to that letter by saying, I too share in their concerns. However, the law that they looked at says that any federally funded transit agency cannot use, you know, these companies. And what I point out to them is that, look, there's you left out and a huge loophole in that a lot of local communities are going to be looking at public-private partnerships, and there may not be a need for federal money. So if you're talking about the safety and security of the nation, then you need to close the loophole. It says any project with companies that are state-controlled by the Chinese government. You cannot participate. You cannot purchase that kind of rolling stock. I agree with them, and I think that's something that needs to be done. But absent that, I have to abide by the laws of the United States and the state of Florida. And so I need, you know, right now there's nothing that says that we can't. They need to modify the law to protect the American citizen.
What have you spoken with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber? He's spoken
yes.
out and said he's got issues
yeah,
with this because
sure.
he doesn't want a monorail that's just going to take people to a casino. They
Correct.
Want to build a casino there, but that has not been
no,
decided.
I mean,
but
right.
you know what he said.
Of course. But by the same token, there is nothing in the unsolicited proposal that talks about a casino or tied to a casino. The Genting obviously is a casino company, but it's going to be pretty hard to get casino gaming any additional
still
expansion.
Still needs state permission.
Yeah.
The state hasn't decided.
No, it needs the vote of the people of the state of Florida, 60%, because there was a change in the Constitution. Now, can they purchase one of these existing gaming rights like a Magic City Casino? They could do that, all right. But one of the things, the way to handle that would be through zoning, and I think the city of Miami has already put together a pretty stringent restriction on the expansion of gaming. And I understand where the mayor of Miami Beach is coming from, and I may not disagree with him. But again, this is an unsolicited proposal. It doesn't mean that is the company or the area where
they have
this
to win the bid.
Exactly.
And, okay. Real quickly, just to finish up on this conversation on this is, how long have you been talking with Genting about this? And we did get a tweet from one of the listeners, Rodrigo Gonzalez, asking, have you ever received campaign contributions from Genting? But
yes.
What's your connection with Genting?
Yes, I have received campaign contributions from Genting. I've received campaign contributions from the Fountain Blue, from people that would be opposed to this. And so, in my last campaign, I think we raised about $8 million, people that were for and against. Look, at the end of the day, I look at what is in the best interest of Miami-Dade County. This is a public process. The final decision will be made by the Board of County Commissioners. It's not made by the mayor of Miami-Dade County. I have a pretty good reputation in this town for being honest and above board and being very ethical. Did I get campaign contributions? Yep, I get campaign contributions from a whole lot of people. Some people are probably going to be in favor of whatever comes out, and some people are going to be against. I just I put that aside and say whatever's in the best interest of Miami-Dade County, that's it.
Just to mention, we will have Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gilbert tomorrow on the program. We're talking right now with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. And again, we talked about this idea of a monorail going between Miami and Miami Beach. What was that unsolicited proposal? Where is it going right now? Obviously, a story we'll keep following. You could keep posting your ideas and questions on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let's move to the budget proposal you had. This one is going to be your last one as mayor.
No,
you have one more. My apologies. You have one more after this. Yes. But looking at this one, this is an $8.9 billion spending plan that you have for the county. You keep property tax rates flat. What's the highlight for you of this year's plan?
The highlights is that we're the highlights are A, number one, there's no tax increase, and B, we're increasing services. We're, for the first time in over a decade, actually filling all of the positions in the police department. We're adding 90 additional police officers. We're going to put three more fire rescue units in service. And we have increases in service, throughout the county. We are also embarking and hoping that the commission approves a spending plan of about $1.8 billion over the next 20 years to rehab all of our existing facilities, especially parks, and then those aging county facilities that we've been using a lot of money just in emergency repairs. We can take that same money and actually start to rebuild those facilities and to strengthen our infrastructure to become much more resilient county. So that's basically the highlights of it. We're increasing library hours by the most. We're going to now have the most library hours ever in the history of Miami-Dade County.
No price hikes on train or bus rides?
No, we are not. Although required by the code, I'm going to recommend that we don't have any hikes in our transit fares, and so they should remain flat. At this time, we want to expand transit. We are right now looking at we contracted with the Transit Alliance to look at a way that we can make our bus system more efficient and much more usable. There on that
more
plan
efficient,
is,
but expansion without raising the rates. How do we do that?
I didn't say it was expanded. I said more efficient use.
More efficient, but there was expansion. There's a question of expansion, especially of the rapid bus system.
That system, yes, but that's part of the smart plan, and so we're looking to expand and begin that process of the bus rapid transit, and we want to have gold or platinum. Bus rapid transit is going to be nothing like you've seen. It's not buses like you've seen today. It's a different kind of system.
Discussed on the show.
Yeah, we'll have level boarding. The doors will open. It'll be prepaid, and you'll have a complete right of way on the busway, where you get priority.
Keeping the rate flat, though, yeah. Is there any concern with safety? I mean, this was a story that didn't get a lot of attention. There was a derailment of the Metro Rail not too long ago.
Right.
It
was human error.
Yeah, but I mean,
it was human error.
Is there any worry though of safety?
No.
Okay.
There's a lot of people went out and said, "Oh, look, the system is bad and it's unsafe." But yet, that was human error.
Human error, but you still have to pay for it. Maybe is it because we've looked at this issue about do we have enough people, enough training? It's human error. Yeah, but that has to be. We have to pay to fix that.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
But again, it wasn't because there was some kind of an issue with the track or anything with the signalization. It was human error, and it may have been human error on both sides, both at the control and at the train. So that's something that we're looking at. There's nothing wrong with that track. There was nothing wrong with the signalization. There was nothing wrong with the red and the green lights. We have to pass federal standards, and we do. They have Miami-Dade Transit has sufficient money, the money that they need in order to maintain the Metro Rail system that we have today. We are getting brand new buses as we speak. They're CNG, and we're adding more and more every single day. So the bus fleet is becoming newer and newer. The Metro Rail fleet is going to be completely new by the end of next year, and so you'll see, and you won't see any more of the silver Metro Rail, the old silver Metro Rail trains that have been running around since 1984. They'll be the nice blue ones, and those are brand new. And so we have making a lot of improvements to Miami-Dade Transit.
Let me finish with this, and not to kick you out of office yet. Sure. I apologize about that. But it's just, look, legacy.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about legacy, especially transportation's been a big one for you. So, look, we had the monorail question, the issue with, the bus rapid transit, and now MDX in the fight with the state. But what is it you're trying to build when it comes to legacy, especially transportation?
The only legacy that I want to build is that I left Miami-Dade County in much better shape than when I got it. And believe me, Miami-Dade County today is in much better shape than when I got it. And so it's not about things. It's about our quality of life. It's about the jobs that we have here. What have we transformed Miami-Dade? You know, when I became the mayor, Miami-Dade had an unemployment rate of over 12%. We're at about 3.5% now. We are now transforming the economy from real estate and tourism, and we're becoming more technology-based and service economy. The expansion of the airport, the expansion of the seaport, the creation of jobs. That's what I wanted to do, and also leave Miami-Dade on a sound financial footing. When I first got in office, we were looking at a $400 million budget. Well, we cleaned that up. We tightened our belts. We made some sacrifices, and now the Miami-Dade County government is in much better condition. And I think also Miami-Dade County as a whole is in much better condition than when I became the mayor. That's going to be my legacy. Are there going to be some other things that, hey, look, you got that built in? Yeah, that's fine, but that's not really what I'm about. I'm about leaving something better than when I got it. And I think that so far, I still have another year, over almost a year and a half. I think we're well on our way.
He's done with office in 2020. That's what
November, the end of 2020.
Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, the record heat that we're experiencing, it's likely to get worse. A new scientific study shows why. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It is really hot out there. I mean, it makes you want to just race inside and get to that air conditioning. Well, here's some bad news. That heat is going to get worse in the years to come, likely. This week, the Union for Concerned Scientists released a report called Killer Heat in the United States, Climate Choices and the Future of Dangerously Hot Days. The study predicts that in just 30 years, there will be 105 days that are going to feel like it's 100 degrees or more because of the heat index. Right now in Miami-Dade, there are only 25 days out of the year where we get that. Juan Declet Barreto is the lead author of the study, and he joins me now. Juan, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Hi, how you doing? Indeed, it's very hot.
Tell us about this study. How can you look into the future and foretell what temperatures are going to be and that we're going to have that much, you know, that many days of hot, hot temperatures?
Well, we looked at 18 different models developed by scientists that represent the scientific international community's best scientific estimates of what future extreme temperatures conditions are going to be if we don't take action on climate change to reduce carbon emissions projected out to the mid-century and the late century.
And how accurate is this? You know, when I look at the chart and I'm looking 30 years ahead, and I'm looking at, oh my God, we're going to have that many days and the temperature is going to feel like it's above 105. How accurate is that?
Well, we feel that it reflects very accurately what the best scientific understanding of how the globe will respond to carbon emissions. And it represents the scientific community's best estimates represented through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change across the world of what our planet may look like if we don't take action to reduce emissions.
Now. So you're saying if we take action, we might actually be able to keep this from happening.
That's right. That's one of the things that we found most compelling in our study, is that if we take drastic action of the sorts that the Paris Agreement, that the international community subscribed to reduce emissions, we can avoid the worst consequences of climate change.
Let's take a look at the data that you found and what you're predicting, what these estimates are for South Florida. What do you think in 30 years, what could be the worst situation?
Well, let's take a look, for example. Let's look at what it portends for Miami-Dade County.
Okay.
Historically, Miami-Dade has experienced only, on average, 7 days with a heat index, or it feels like temperature of 105 or more. If we don't take any action to reduce those emissions, to reduce carbon emissions, by the mid-century, that number could climb to 88, so nearly 3 months. Now, if we do take rapid action, we could reduce that to 2 months.
So right now, you're saying we're only feeling about a week's worth of temperatures that feel like it's over 105.
That's correct.
And in 30 years, it could be 88 days?
That's right. Imagine that. I mean, we're talking about the equivalent of 3 months, almost.
And that's, you know, I was looking at the map because this the chart that you guys provide for this data is fascinating. You can look at the map of the United States. You break it up by counties, and you can just move forward 20 years, 30 years, if it's moderate or if it's extreme. And it just seems like the whole country, a lot of the country becomes red. In other words, a lot of the country starts to feel intense heat for a long period of time.
That's right. Not only that, we also found that if we don't take drastic action, we may even lose the ability to accurately communicate to people how hot it is. And that's what we call the off-the-charts days, which are literally off the National Weather Services.
What does that mean exactly? Off-the-chart?
Off-the-chart means that the humidity and temperature data that were used a couple of decades ago to develop the heat index calculations are exceeding. Those temperatures are being exceeded under the projections that we have on climate change, and so that we cannot accurately calculate a heat index.
Let's understand what the heat index is. It's not measuring the temperature. You can measure the temperature for as high as you want, but heat index is a combination of things.
That's right. The temperature is what you can measure on the thermometer, right? Now, the heat index is how that temperature feels like to you as a, in your body.
And what makes it feel so much hotter?
The humidity. I lived in Arizona for a long time where it's naturally dry and hot. Well, you can experience a temperature of, say, 90, but with a low relative humidity of, say, 12%, that temperature probably feels around 80. Now, take that same temperature and add and factor in a humidity of 68%, like something like we had yesterday, or maybe a little bit higher. Well, that can feel near 90 or 100, so it's significant.
Why is it worse? This is interesting. So you lived in Arizona. I lived in Las Vegas, so I know what it's like. Temperature can get up 110, 111 degrees, but it's dry. It's a dry heat. We always keep hearing that.
That's right.
So what's worse? What's the difference in understanding? Like, we'll never get to 110 like it gets in Las Vegas, but it can get to 98, 97, 98, but that heat index, the humidity kicks in and it feels way worse.
That's right. With the humidity, a high humidity, it feels way worse. And that is one of the main impacts that we are seeing, and one of the worst hit places is going to be the southeastern region, in Florida in particular, southern Florida in particular. That humidity at some point generates or helps drive up the heat index to a point where your body loses the ability to cool off, to sweat, and eliminate the excess heat. At 105 heat index values, it's not just vulnerable people or elderly people or very young children or people with physical or mental disabilities. It's everybody who's exposed to those temperatures could potentially perish or end up in the hospital.
You know, I mean, you're the scientist who's looking at the data trying to estimate what's coming, but as just a person, as a human being, what do you think when you see that data? You read it back at yourself and say, wait a second, what's the world going to look like? You're going to be around probably to see that.
That's right. You know, I mean, quite frankly, it's wild. I mean, as a scientist, as a father, as a husband, somebody who has small children, it's very concerning that if we don't compel our leaders to take the drastic action that we need to take to reduce carbon emissions from our transportation sector, from an energy sector, from most areas in our economy, that we will not be able to fend off the worst. So it's very worrisome.
Again, I'm talking with Juan Declet Barreto. He's an environmental climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists and the lead author of the study that again looks at this the rising temperatures. And the study is called Killer Heat in the United States: Climate Choices and the Future of Dangerously Hot Days. And again, as he's been saying, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Co-author.
Co-author, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. You know, as the study points out, again, that these days that we're feeling, this heat that we're feeling, we're going to get more and more days in the future. Right now we're feeling a couple of weeks worth of these hot temperatures, but in the next 20, 30, 40 years, we're going to feel months of these kind of hot temperatures. You talk about policymakers, lawmakers. And I wonder, I mean, this study comes out and we feel this heat now, and now you're telling us it could get worse. But I'm wondering, How should policymakers and lawmakers look at the data that you've just now provided? What should they be doing with that?
Well, at the international level, I think the first thing that is echoed by the rest of the scientific community in the country is that the United States needs to remain in the Paris Agreement. President Trump has indicated his intention to remove the United States from the Paris Agreement. It's something that cannot happen until after 2020, but just signaling to the rest of the world that the United States is not going to participate in the agreement is telling the rest of the world that the United States is not taking its obligations on climate change seriously, that it's not treating climate change as a crisis that it is. In the domestic front, one of the key plans and protections from the Environmental Protection Agency that are currently being dismantled by the Trump administration is the Clean Power Plan, which is a plan to reduce carbon emissions from the power sector, which accounts for roughly 40% of the U.S. carbon footprint. And so those are key systemic changes that need to occur, that the United States needs to be a leader on.
How much of this is about dealing with the issue, which is a global issue of climate change, and how much of it is about, you know what, we just have to prepare for these temperatures, and that's about livability. It's just about, you know, we talk about sea level rise, we're going to have to prepare for it and just start to think how we live our lives with it.
We need to do both things, but we're talking about this adaptation, right? Some of us can adapt, you know, some of us will have the means to drive in our cars, turn on our AC and drive over to our air conditioned office. But many people do not have that. I was just over in Overtown where it's really, really hot. And we know there are many low-income people in such communities who cannot afford to use an operator by an air conditioning unit, who basically cannot adapt their way out of this. So what we really need is to mitigate those carbon emissions, to compel our leaders and our utilities and our private sector to make the changes that are needed in order to wean us away from fossil fuels into renewable sources of energy so that we can avoid the worst.
How often do you get to talk to lawmakers, though? On any level?
Myself, I don't talk that often to them, but we at the Union of Concerned Scientists, we craft our research in such a way that it makes sense to implement into policy, to make it straightforward, to communicate to the public and to lawmakers how we can help design solutions to the climate change crisis. That's what we're focused on. And so I would like to send people home with the message that while this future that we're talking about in our research looks very dire, it should be compelling to people. It should compel people to argue for solutions, to demand solutions from our leaders, and we have those solutions. We need the political will to put those solutions in practice.
So this is on a grander scale. There's just a bigger issue here of global warming, of climate change. But when you look at on the local level, you know, one of the things that I found interesting is the challenge sometimes with cities, the urban centers, is that it generates a lot of heat because, again, you just have a large population, but also a lot of concrete and steel and pavement. So is that something that's discussed or something that you could talk to lawmakers about? Like, think about how you rebuild your cities in trying to help deal with that heat.
Certainly. What you're referring to as the urban heat island, which cities, because of concrete and asphalt and other surfaces, makes the city hotter, is outside of the scope of our study. But we do recognize that there is a great deal that can be done at the regional level, at the state level, at the local level, by cities and councils of governments and authorities that do long-term planning for cities, to how cities are designed, to plan for, to adapt to climate change, to mitigate carbon emissions. One of the things that we saw, that I saw in some of my own research in Phoenix, was that air conditioning waste, heat waste from air conditioning units, feeds back into the city and exacerbates the urban heat island. It's not an insignificant contribution to heat in the cities.
And then as it gets hotter, we're going to be using a lot more air conditioning.
Exactly. And as it gets hotter, you use more conditioning, you'll drive up energy demand. And if we don't wean ourselves away from fossil fuels, then we're going to continue burning more more fossil fuels.
How about planting more trees?
There's scientific evidence that shows that trees can help, you know, these natural measures, you know, to clean the air, to absorb CO2 and so on. And those can work, but the most the rapid action that we need to take is to reduce the source of the emissions, not just accept and take for granted a world in which we will continue to emit CO2 into the air, but a world in which we can slow down those emissions.
You talk about what they're trying to figure out in Phoenix and dealing with air conditioners. I know that some cities out west, like San Francisco, they're painting their buildings white, again, trying to reflect more of the heat away from that urban core. I mean, do you think that's just kind of what we're going to have to do in a lot of cases?
I think there are some of those mitigation sort of or adaptation sort of measures, like painting roofs white. Or planting green roofs, or using cool pavements some other sorts of materials. But the scale at which those will operate will be circumscribed to the cities and the regional areas. It's important because we also know that there are many disparities in how hot it gets in different neighborhoods in different cities,
right.
And that has to do with the lack of vegetation. And that typically happens more often in low-income neighborhoods, in communities of color.
Where does this study go next? What happens now?
Well, one of the things that we are interested in doing is talking to communities that are impacted by heat. For example, coming here to Miami and going over to Overtown for a little bit is part of what we will do, a follow-up analysis, where we would like to engage with communities that are affected and try to develop further research questions that answer questions about, well, who's going to be more impacted? Who's going to end up in the hospital? How can we mitigate this? What are some equitable ways in which we can inform policies to deal with this and reduce exposure among the most vulnerable.
It's still hard to believe sometimes there are a lot of people who do not have access to something as simple as air conditioning, and it's just going to get hotter and hotter. Juan Declet Barreto, again, environmental climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of the study, again, called Killer Heat in the United States. Fascinating information. You can find more at our website, WLRN.org. Juan, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
All right, still to come, robots and technology moving to a lot of parts of our daily lives. How about this? Med school. It's coming up next.
Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city.
Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, have you ever gone to the hospital for a basic procedure and had a young doctor in training work on you? Yeah, I have. And I had stitches, and I remember three young doctors all standing around me working on me. And I thought, wait a second, give me the real doctor. Well, it's an essential part of training the next generation of doctors. But advancements in medical technology are drastically changing and enhancing these training programs. Miami-Dade College's new Center for Learning, Innovation, and Simulation opened yesterday. It includes robotic mannequins for students to operate on. They can cry, simulate different medical conditions. They can even give birth. Yep. They're part of a new world of medical tech. Joining me now, Dr. Brian Stewart. He's the president of Miami-Dade College's medical campus. Dr. Stewart, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here with you.
Okay. What percentage of training for doctors, for future doctors, is on real people, and what, how much of it's mannequins and robots?
So we have a number of programs on our campus. In our nursing program, for instance, the Board of Nursing allows us to go up to 50% on training on simulation. But right now we're at 20. With our new building, we'll be able to escalate that usage.
Is that the way that medicine is going? Do you want to, as a doctor, do you want to see it go that direction?
Well, I think what you want is you want students practicing on those mannequins before they're in the clinical rotation with real patients. We can control what those students experience, what they learn before they're with a real patient, to your point, getting stitches and seeing young doctors. We don't like to talk about trauma, but we can do things, take patients that are very serious and even kill a patient that you'd rather experience there and hope you never experience in a clinical setting.
How do you describe these mannequins? Tell me about them. I mean, for heaven's sakes, they can give birth. Okay, explain this to me.
So we have three levels of mannequins. We have lower level, mid-level, and high-fidelity mannequins. Certainly the one giving birth is a high-level mannequin. They speak over 50 languages, which is another major part of what we do, because we want our students to be able to speak to the patients. But we have numerous scenarios with that baby that we can deliver a C-section, whatever particular method we want to teach the student at that time.
Where are these mannequins coming from, by the way?
Well, we've purchased our mannequins from a company called Gumar, who quite frankly are from Miami, Florida, which we're very proud to support local economy. But there are a number of companies around the country that make them. There's three or four major ones. And Gumar is one of the really, really good ones.
So again, as a doctor, you kind of touched on it a second ago, but as a doctor, I want to know what are the advantages of using a mannequin like that compared to a real person?
You know, the mannequins simulate exactly what a physician or a nurse or a practitioner would see in the real world. They can have breathing issues. They can have heart issues. We can program them to do almost anything we want them to do. One of the big things our faculty have to do is go through training and be able to manipulate those mannequins. The other important aspect, I think, is we can do a lot of corporate training. We can bring in, and I've had a lot of meetings with Jackson and Baptist and all the Miami Jewish, Mount Sinai, and they can bring their nurses and do their continuing education credit and stay up to speed and experience new changes in technology.
You know, because up to this point, sometimes you use real people. These are actors who will, you know, again, perform whatever it is you need to have your people practice on and learn on. But, you know, I wonder when it comes to the mannequins compared to the real actors, cost has to play a part, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, our nursing, Victoria is what we call her. We have two Victorias that can deliver babies, is over $80,000 for each mannequin. But you know, they're very, very high-tech mannequins. We have to have technicians that maintain those. And quite frankly, there are new degrees in maintaining those mannequins. That's one of the new programs I want to start, is training students to work in hospitals to maintain these mannequins. All the hospitals have mannequins, just not the floor and the level that we do.
Is there a way you can prove, you can show an instance, for example, where training on these kind of mannequins or technology actually saved lives?
You know, in our EMS program, we're the only school in Florida that has an ambulance box that moves. And so our EMS students have to practice doing an IV in a moving vehicle. Well, doing it in that simulator allows them, when they're in a site riding with Miramar Fire Department or whomever, to have practiced that so they don't make an error with a patient.
That's an interesting point. Didn't even think of that. Again, talking with Dr. Brian Stewart, president of Miami-Dade College's medical campus. MDC, again, opened up its new Center for Learning, Innovation, and Simulation yesterday. You can find more details and learn about registering for classes coming up here this fall at WLRN.org. You know, Dr. Stewart, you told my producers that you went to a conference last month that was exploring the use of virtual reality in medicine. How would that work?
Well, a couple of things. We actually have a 3D virtual room where the goggles that you wear, the ocular goggles that you in gaming, you can use those goggles and do a virtual surgery or virtual, you know, any number of scenarios. The thing I saw at the conference were those glasses taking our mannequins and putting them in 3D. So, for instance, if you're delivering a baby and the shoulder gets dislocated, you can see it with those goggles inside the mannequin is being delivered.
So you're saying you're not seeing an animated, you're seeing an actual, you know, the physical video or picture of people.
Right.
Of
right.
A person.
In that scenario, you would be with the mannequin seeing the baby being delivered. In the virtual room we have, we would be doing virtual surgeries, potentially.
So how do you see this being used in the future?
Well, I think what it does is it allows us to, you know, clinical rotations are very competitive. You know, we have 1,700 nurses in our nursing program, for instance, and we have to have clinical rotations for all those nursing students. So allowing us to replace some of those clinical rotations with simulation allows us to enroll more students and to make sure, as I said before, that our students have completed certain competencies before we put them with a real patient.
You know, will virtual reality tools, and I love to go through, for example, like Wired magazine or some of these other tech websites. I love to see what's coming in the future, what people are trying to invent. But I wonder if virtual reality tools and simulated devices really ever truly are able to replace human training, actual human training. It all seems so cool, but I mean, is that the best way to go?
Well, no, I think you still need that bedside interaction with a nurse, with a patient. You know, that's critical. I don't think technology can ever replace that. One of the things I talked to my faculty about is in the year 2030, 50% of the jobs don't exist yet. And so we as a college have to be ready to respond to that. And some of those are technology related. You know, think about the advances in medicine in the last 5 years. And, you know, 12 years from now, who knows where we'll be?
You know, we always talk about robots and where robots are going to start to move in and move us out. In medicine, what do you see? Where do you see robots? And not just these mannequins, but I mean just in the actual surgery itself.
Well, there are hospitals now that have robots that deliver things in the hospital. I was in the VA hospital here a few months ago and walked across a robot, got in the elevator with me, knew where he was going, delivering. It's crazy.
But how about in the surgery room? Do you see this?
Yeah, you know, we do have an OR on our campus that we're very excited, a surgery room that allows us to bring multiple disciplines in. And I do think that there's already surgery that's doing what you're talking about.
Will they be essential in reducing, and let's come back to the mannequins actually here, talking about those, are they going to be essential in reducing liability insurance and the dangers that are associated with, again, young doctors who are still learning, they're in their, you know, in their first couple of years? How do you see that playing out?
You know, one of the things is we put students in hospital settings, their experience that they do before they go to a hospital is critical. What we can run them through, the simulations, the scenarios, all the checkoff procedures, I think are critical, because we want our students, and our students, by the way, are with a faculty member, a preceptor. They're never alone in a hospital setting. But I think the more practice they get, the more things they can do in our simulation, the better student nurses they're going to be, and ultimate better employees.
Do you have any concerns, any fears about this technology as it becomes more prevalent? I mean, you know, where are there perhaps kinks that have to be worked out?
I have no fear. I you know, if you go across the country, you're seeing more and more simulation facilities like Miami-Dade College is built. I think what we've done is the technology and the volume of different programs that we have in that building. But you see a lot of hospitals take their nursing teams and physicians and put them on simulators. Every health professional has to keep their continuing education credits up. And so simulation is a great way to do that. Also going to conferences, but actually that hands-on practice with simulators, I think, is essential to be in a good health profession.
You said a moment ago, you said, you know what, in 10, 20, 30 years, there's technology